This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, introducing Pete's e-cups, letting you send a friend a cup. On the web at Pete's.com. That's double P, excuse me, that's P-E-E-T-S. And stay tuned for the KABU Morning News. Bye. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 22nd, and this is a KABU Morning News. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Carlos Chavez.
Coming up on this program, Multnomah County health officials say thousands of children might need to be revaccinated. A report shows that since 2002, almost 100 prisoners have died in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. And U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, has called for meetings in the Security Council on UN corruption. The UN says Bolton is lessening their power. Weather for today calls for rain with temperatures around 50 degrees.
Oregon's Supreme Court has resuscitated the controversial property rights law that could blanket rural Oregon in suburban sprawl. Yesterday, the Oregon Supreme Court, in a sweeping unanimous decision, ruled that Measure 37 did not violate state and federal constitutions as a lower court had determined. Their decision, which will be dissected across the nation, jumpstarts more than 2,500 applications to develop land controlled by government regulations. Measure 37 has remained one of Oregon's most contentious issues since voters approved it in November 2004. It is widely viewed as a shift in Oregon's unique approach to planning, reserving the country for agriculture, and concentrating people in cities. Oregonians from the coast to the Wallowa Mountains have applied to develop their land under Measure 37.
Kroger, the parent company of Fred Meyer, said today that it has decided to stop carrying ground beef products packaged using carbon monoxide to keep meat an appealing pink color. The decision arose from uncertainty over the pros and cons of using the gas. The use of carbon monoxide was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2004. Natural food extract maker Kalsec Foods of Kalamazoo, Michigan, has petitioned the FDA to ban the practice because it deceives shoppers who depend on color to help them avoid spoiled meat. The gas gives meat a bright pink color that lasts for weeks. The meat industry hopes the process can save as much as $1 billion it says it loses annually from having to discount or discard meat that is reasonably fresh and perfectly safe, but no longer pretty. Critics, however, say the FDA violated its own rules by allowing the practice without a formal evaluation of its effects on consumer safety. This is from the Oregonian.
Multnomah County health officials said thousands of children might need new shots because vaccines at some clinics were stored at temperatures that were either too warm or too cold. It involves 25,000 doses of vaccine that were stored at 8 Multnomah County health clinics during the past 3 years. Lorraine Duncan, head of immunization programs for the Oregon Department of Human Services, said, "This is the biggest breakdown in vaccine storage in Oregon's history." The childhood vaccinations in question include those for pneumococcal disease, tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, polio, measles, mumps, rubella, haemophilus, influenza type B, hepatitis B, and viral influenza.
The Corvallis City Council passed a resolution yesterday which calls on the United States government to make plans to bring troops home from Iraq. KABU's Michael Papadopoulos was there and filed this report.
I went to the city council meeting today. They had an important resolution, and they passed it. What was the resolution about? It was about bringing the troops home. It wasn't bring them home immediately. They urged the U.S. government to commence planning an orderly, rapid, and comprehensive withdrawal of the U.S. military personnel from Iraq. They called on the President and the Congress to support our troops by ensuring that the returning veterans receive compensation and care, etc., etc. And they urge the U.S. government to provide the people of Iraq with appropriate non-military aid, as may be necessary for the security of Iraq's citizens and for rebuilding. Urges the U.S. government to establish a plan for the ongoing transition of responsibility for internal security activities in the military forces of the Iraqi government, and urges the U.S. government to pursue security and stability in Iraq through diplomacy. You see, this was a fairly mild measure, but nevertheless, there were two people who were opposed. And the reason they were opposed, and the only reason for any opposition that we've heard, is that city councils shouldn't get into national politics. That's my news. I'm Michael Papadopoulos, speaking from Corvallis.
The state postponed condemned murderer Michael Morales' execution indefinitely yesterday. The move came just 2 hours before the killing was scheduled to begin because prison officials could not comply with a federal judge's latest order to revise California's lethal injection procedures. The execution was postponed when two anesthesiologists withdrew their agreement to monitor the injection of a three-drug sequence and to make sure Morales was unconscious as he was being put to death. The state then proposed to execute Morales with a massive dose of the barbiturate sodium pentothal. Yesterday afternoon, U.S. District Judge Jeremy Fogel imposed further conditions to minimize the risk of a botched and painful execution. Morales was to have been put to death for raping, bludgeoning, and stabbing 17-year-old Terry Winchell in January 1981. The last prisoner California executed did not receive the same consideration. Stanley Tookie Williams was put to death without any objections from the governor, the judge, or the anesthesiologist. The week before Williams was killed, evidence had emerged that he was not innocent of the crimes he had been charged with.
Three Muslim men from the Middle East, currently living in Ohio, have been charged with plotting terrorist attacks against U.S. and coalition troops in Iraq and other countries. One of the men, a citizen of both the U.S. and Jordan, also was accused of threatening to kill or injure President Bush, according to an indictment released yesterday. All three had lived in Toledo within the past year and were arrested over the weekend, two of them in Toledo and the third in Jordan. An unidentified person with a military background helped the U.S. government foil the plot by working with suspects while secretly gathering evidence. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez also did not exclude the use of warrantless wiretapping in the investigation, but said prosecutors were careful not to jeopardize the case. One of the men's lawyers said that the government was overzealous in bringing the charges. The three pleaded not guilty in federal courts in Cleveland and Toledo. The most serious charges could bring life in prison. Gonzalez and other officials refused to say whether an attack was imminent, and FBI agents monitored the defendants for about a year and a half. The indictment says the group also traveled together to a shooting range to practice and study how to make explosives. It alleges that at least one of the men released or researched and tried to obtain government grants and private funding for the training.
Defense lawyer for Al-Qaeda conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui said yesterday they want to compel a reluctant Pennsylvania congressman to testify at Moussaoui's death penalty trial. Moussaoui's lawyers had subpoenaed Republican Representative Kurt Weldon to testify for Moussaoui's defense. Weldon asked the court to quash the subpoena. Weldon said he didn't want to be used by a thug like Moussaoui and claimed congressional immunity from the subpoena. Weldon has claimed the government knew more about the September 11th hijackers before the 2001 attack than it had publicly admitted. Specifically, he claims a secret military intelligence project known as Able Danger identified some of the hijackers well before they flew planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Weldon wrote in a book that he himself saw one of the unit's charts listing some September 11th hijackers. How much the government knew about the hijackers before September 11th attack will be a key issue at Moussaoui's sentencing. Moussaoui pleaded guilty in April to conspiring with Al-Qaeda to fly planes into U.S. buildings, but he denies any involvement in the September 11th attacks and says he was training to fly a plane into the White House as part of a possible future attack. This according to The Guardian.
President Bush has endorsed a takeover of shipping operations at six major U.S. seaports by a state-owned business in the United Arab Emirates. He pledged to veto any bill Congress might approve to block the agreement. Bush yesterday defended his administration's earlier approval of the sale of London-based Peninsular and Oriental Steam Navigation Company to Dubai Ports World. This despite concerns in Congress it could increase the possibility of terrorism at American ports. The sale is expected to be finalized in early March after public attention has shifted to the next big thing. The deal will put Dubai ports in charge of major shipping operations in New York, New Jersey, Baltimore, New Orleans, Miami, and Philadelphia. Lawmakers from both parties have noted that some of the September 11th hijackers used the United Arab Emirates as an operational and financial base. In addition, critics contend that the UAE was an important transfer point for shipments of smuggled nuclear components sent to Iran, North Korea, and Libya by a Pakistani scientist. They say a port operator complicit in smuggling or terrorism could manipulate manifests and other records to frustrate Homeland Security's already limited scrutiny of shipping containers and slip contraband past U.S. Customs inspectors.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said that the Pentagon is reviewing its practice of paying to plant stories in the Iraqi news media, withdrawing his earlier claim that it had been stopped. Rumsfeld told reporters he was mistaken in the earlier assertion. He had said in a speech in New York last Friday and in a television interview the same day that the controversial practice had been stopped and that General George Casey, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, was reviewing the practice. Previously, Casey has said he saw no reason to stop it. Pentagon spokesman Brian Whitman and Donald Rumsfeld had been incorrect in saying on Friday that the practice of paying for positive stories in the Iraqi media had been halted in the wake of negative publicity in the United States. An official inquiry into the program by the Navy has been completed, but its results have not been publicly released.
Since August of 2002, almost 100 prisoners have died in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan, according to U.S. groups Human Rights First, this from the BBC. At least 34 of the 98 deaths were suspect or confirmed homicides. The Pentagon told BBC Newsnight it had not seen the report but took allegations of maltreatment very seriously and would prosecute if necessary. The report, which is to be published today, used information from the Pentagon and other official U.S. sources. Human Rights First Representative Deborah Perlstein told Newsnight she was extremely comfortable that the information was reliable. The 34 cases classified in the report as homicides were described as caused by intentional or reckless behavior, and another 11 cases have been deemed suspicious and that between 8 and 12 prisoners were tortured to death. UK MP Bob Marshall Andrews said that the report confirmed in statistical terms the appalling evidence already available in footage. A spokesman for Amnesty International UK called for a probe into the deaths in custody.
After the State of the Union address in which President Bush said Americans were addicted to oil, the Bush administration has been touting the benefits of renewable energy. However, Bush's visit today to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, the premier lab in U.S. for researching renewable energy technologies, comes just weeks after $28 million was cut from the lab's budget. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conrad in Boulder, Colorado.
After the State of the Union address in which President Bush said Americans were addicted to oil, the Bush administration has been touting the benefits of renewable energy. However, Bush's visit today to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, the premier lab in the U.S. for researching renewable energy technologies, comes just weeks after $28 million was cut from the lab's budget. George Douglas, spokesperson for the NREL.
Well, what the lab did to make up that $28 million was cut money wherever possible, delayed or canceled some subcontracts, that is contracts with industry and academia outside to do research, and then ended up still with not enough money to keep everyone employed. And so we had to lay off 32 people on February 7th.
The lab announced on Monday that $5 million in funding would be restored by the Department of Energy, which will allow them to reinstate the 32 workers. However, they are still facing a budget deficit of $23 million. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran in Boulder, Colorado.
Fourth quarter profits fell sharply for Taser International Incorporated as safety concerns depressed sales of its stun guns, and its shares declined by 12%. This from Reuters. Taser has faced a bombardment of lawsuits and bad publicity over deaths linked to its weapons. Sales fell 34% to $12.6 million, while general and administrative expenses rose by 50%. Many U.S. police departments still use the weapons, but many law enforcement agencies have held off ordering more Tasers as safety concerns continue to dog the company. Tasers, which disable victims with a 50,000-volt shock, have been linked to more than 100 deaths since 2001, according to human rights group Amnesty International. Taser says its weapons actually save lives when used by police officers as an alternative to guns. So far, the company has faced 12 wrongful death and personal injury suits, but each has been dismissed.
The Supreme Court said yesterday it would consider reinstating a federal ban on what opponents call partial birth abortion. The action pulls the contentious issue back to the High Court on conservative Justice Samuel Alito's first day. Alito could well be the tie-breaking vote when the court decides if doctors can be jailed for performing the abortion procedure. It is the first time the court has considered a federal restriction on abortion, and conservatives said they expect the membership change to affect the outcome. Justices split 5-4 in 2000 in striking down a state law barring the same procedure because it lacked an exception to protect the health of the mother. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the tie-breaking vote, retired late last month and was replaced by Alito. Abortion was a major focus in the fight over Alito's nomination and that of new Chief Justice John Roberts. Neither divulged how he would vote. Even with O'Connor's retirement, there are 5 votes to uphold Roe v. Wade, the 1973 landmark ruling that established a woman's right to an abortion. Abortion rights groups were worried, however, that the new court would make it easier for legislators to limit women's access to abortions. Justices will hear arguments this fall as voters are preparing for midterm elections, with a ruling likely next year as presidential campaigns are gearing up. Justices were told that 31 states also barred so-called partial birth abortions over the past 8 years. Doctors who perform the procedure contend that it is the safest method of abortion when the mother's health is threatened by heart disease, high blood pressure, or cancer.
A former Sago mine foreman was indicted yesterday on federal charges that he falsified inspection reports at the mine in 2004 and was never certified as a miner or mining foreman. The 116-count indictment against Robert Dennison is not related to the January 2nd explosion that led to the deaths of 12 miners. If convicted, Dennison could face up to 5 years in prison and $10,000 in fines for each of the 113 counts. He could receive up to 5 years and $250,000 in fines for each of the remaining counts. Dennison was never issued an underground miner's card, and his only certification is as a mining truck driver. On his first inspection form, Dennison allegedly failed to include his foreman certification number on subsequent inspections, the indictment says. He listed a number that belongs to a foreman who does not know Dennison. The indictment also alleges that Dennison lied to an investigator with the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration who questioned him. The Sago mine was cited for 208 alleged safety violations during 2005, at least 17 of which were considered serious.
New Jersey has become the second state in the nation to institute criminal penalties for broadcasting a radio signal without a license or aiding and abetting those broadcasts. While pirate radio operators have no voice in the debate and media monopolies push the bills, Florida legislators passed a similar law in 2004. but putting enforcement in the hands of local authorities may lead to disputes between the states, and as Andrew Stelzer reports from Tampa, the laws themselves may do nothing to stem the tide of pirate radio stations.
On July 1, 2004, Florida made it a third-degree felony to broadcast without a license, punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. Almost a year later, Bob Noxious, who had appeared in newspapers as a pirate radio operator and advocate, was broadcasting a variety of programs, including punk, metal, and hip-hop on 99.9 FM in St. Petersburg, when he came home one day.
I was tipped off by my neighbors, fortunately, who said, "Hey, Bob, there's people in black suits here with sunglasses and black government cars asking questions about you. What's going on?" At that point, that's when it was over.
A few days later, FCC agents came and confronted Noxious at his job, armed with pictures.
In the picture, there was my equipment, and they had surveillance pictures of the outside of my apartment with the windows, and they showed how they lined up to the windows inside the apartment. They showed my coaxial cable going out the window, and you could see where it went up the antenna outside. They pretty much had me nailed. They said that I was breaking the law. I committed a third-degree felony. It was punishable by up to a year in prison, $11,000 fine.
Noxious says the FCC agents also presented information about his personal life, including his kids and what schools they went to. He asked for a lawyer who was offered a deal by the FCC that if Noxious gave up his equipment, they'd drop the charges. Noxious's lawyer counteroffered, and since then he has not heard back from the FCC. Florida has gotten a reputation as a hotbed of pirate radio. Philip Roberts, the president of the New Jersey Broadcasters Association, lobbied for that state's law, which has penalties of up to 18 months in jail and $10,000 in fines. He believes jail time is the only deterrent that will keep pirates from setting back up again.
The FCC, in their anti-piracy efforts, doesn't have direct enforcement power. It has to depend on the state's attorney to get the enforcement done, and that sometimes can take months and sometimes years. And meanwhile, audiences are being deprived of their favorite radio station because a pirate is causing interference.
Despite the fact that pirate radio is not as big a problem in New Jersey as in Florida, Robert says there was virtually unanimous support of the law.
No opposition at all. Pirates can very well go before the legislature and explain why they're doing something illegal.
Robert says unlicensed signals can interfere with emergency or amber alerts, but Alan Pitts with the American Radio Relay League, an amateurs association based in Connecticut, says giving enforcement powers to local law enforcement agencies is inappropriate.
The ARL would have concern if any state starts deciding to start making their own laws and, in a sense, preempting the federal government on an area that is reserved only for the federal government.
Pitts believes that lax enforcement by the FCC has led to an increase in the number of pirate stations, causing states to take matters into their own hands. But Noxious, like many unlicensed broadcasters, chose to go on air because he was frustrated by the lack of choices on the corporate-dominated radio dial, and thinks that harsher legislation is simply a way for the increasingly fewer number of media conglomerates to monopolize the airwaves.
Well, I don't listen to the corporate radio stations anymore. There's nothing good to listen to unless you like the same 20 songs that they play over and over and over and over and over and over again. The companies that own all the stations, they don't want this little guy coming in and taking their listeners away. Even though I may only have a few of their listeners, they want every single one of them.
There have been no prosecutions under the New Jersey law so far. In Florida, one man pleaded guilty to a lesser misdemeanor charge after he was caught renting out office and tower space to people who ran two Haitian FM pirate stations from the premises. He had to pay almost $3,000 in fines. For FSRN, from WMNF Radio in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
State prosecutors in Munich, Germany, have launched an investigation to determine if Germany secretly helped the CIA in the abduction of one of its citizens, wrongfully accused of terrorism, who was held and tortured in a U.S. renditions jail in Afghanistan. This from The Independent. Khalid al-Masri, a German of Lebanese descent who was kidnapped in Macedonia by the CIA and flown to an American-run prison in Kabul, where he was detained for 5 months and repeately beaten in early 2004. The German government has denied complicity in the kidnapping, which caused outrage in Germany last year and prompted Chancellor Angela Merkel to demand an explanation from U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. But Munich state prosecutors confirmed they were investigating Masri's allegation that a German agent interrogated him at the U.S. prison in Kabul. Masri identified a senior German police official he suspected of being his interrogator from a 10-person lineup conducted in the presence of his lawyer at a police station in his hometown in southern Germany. Police and state prosecutors were refusing to reveal the true identity of the man he picked out in the lineup. The New York Times yesterday quoted one of the unidentified man's colleagues as saying that the man often took part in undercover operations and helped with dirty work for the German Foreign Intelligence Services.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has called for meetings this week in the Security Council on allegations of corruption and sex abuse in UN peacekeeping missions, reigniting a dispute between the world body's power players and a group of developing nations. The group of 77, which includes 132 mainly developing countries and China, is accusing U.S. Ambassador John Bolton of encroaching on the UN General Assembly's turf by holding meetings on the allegations in the Security Council. The group of 77 maintains the allegations should be handled by the General Assembly, where its members constitute a strong majority. The United States this month holds the rotating Security Council presidency, and Bolton is insisting on holding meetings today and tomorrow on the allegations. At the heart of the struggle is what Secretary General Kofi Annan said. The General's Assembly's feeling is that its power and its influence is being diminished. The Security Council has become the dominant UN body because it deals with issues of peace and security. And its five permanent members, the United States, Russia, China, Britain, and France, have veto power. In the General Assembly, the 191 members each have one vote, and there is no veto.
Acting Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said last night that government officials were looking into the sale of his Jerusalem house to a U.S. businessman. Olmert told Israeli TV that he turned over documents concerning the sale to the state comptroller. Israeli newspaper Haaretz said Olmert sold the home in 2004 for $2.7 million to an offshore company controlled by U.S. tycoon S. Daniel Abraham, who contributed to an earlier Olmert election campaign. The paper said the sale price was high, but not unreasonable. It said Olmert still lives in the house, paying rent at about half the going rate. Olmert has been mentioned in several corruption cases over the years, but has never been charged. And he says he always denied any wrongdoing. Several parties running against Olmert's Kadima party are trying to capitalize on police investigations of Kadima leaders, including founder Ariel Sharon and his sons.
A bomb attack in Iraq has badly damaged one of the holiest sites in Shia Islam, sparking furious protests. Thousands of Iraqis have gathered at the Al-Askari Shrine in Samarra, north of Baghdad, where two men blew up the famous Golden Dome in a dawn raid. Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the spiritual head of Iraq's Shia Muslims, has called for a week of mourning. Shias in Baghdad attacked at least five Sunni mosques in reprisal raids. Disturbances were reported in other cities. The shrine is one of two tombs in Samarra for revered Shia imams. Many thousands of pilgrims from around the world visit the two shrines annually. The attack came just one day after at least 22 people died when a car bomb exploded in a market in a Shia neighborhood of southern Baghdad. The BBC's correspondent in Baghdad says the attack was almost certainly designed to raise the existing tensions between the majority Shia and minority Sunni populations. There were no immediate reports of injuries in today's attack, but there are fears that people may have been trapped in the rubble.
And Iran has offered to help finance the cash-strapped Palestinian Authority governed by Hamas. The offer was announced by senior security official Ali Larijani after a meeting with Hamas Politburo Chief Khaled Mashal. The decision follows moves by the U.S. and Israel to isolate a Hamas-led government with financial penalties. Hamas has also held initial talks with Fatah to discuss forming a coalition. Larijani criticized the U.S. government's decision to withdraw aid and questioned its commitment to democracy. He said, "You know very well that Hamas is a genuine popular movement which has always pursued the objective of recovering the rights of the oppressed Palestinian people. But unfortunately, the Americans have never paid any attention to this matter. On Monday, Iran's supreme leader expressed support for Hamas and called on other Muslim nations to provide financial aid. This from the BBC.
That's the Cable Morning News for Wednesday, February 22nd, 2006. Weather for today calls for rain with temperatures around 50. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Our assistant producer is Chris Andre. Our engineer is Boone Rivas. The KBOO Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Stay tuned at 7:30 on the Whole Communities Radio Project. The guest will be Jim Lobby from Audubon, Kim Dixon from the Environmental Justice Action Group, and Jill Fuglister from the Coalition for a Livable Future to discuss the Regional Equity Atlas. At 9, hear a movie talk with Ed, DK, and Don reviewing the latest movies. At 9:30 on Speaking of Animals, the topic is wolf hunting. Host Lori speaks with Priscilla Farrell and Friends of Animals about a battle in Alaska over wolf hunting and wolf control. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller interviews geologist Kenneth DeFays about the global oil production and the impact of its peak. He has recently authored Hubbard's Peak and Beyond Oil, The View from Hubbard's Peak. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. That's all right here on KBOO, your community, non-corporate, volunteer-powered and listener-sponsored radio station. And be sure to catch the KBOO Evening News at 5. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome to the community calendar for Wednesday, the 22nd of February. SCRAP, the School and Community Reuse Action Project, has volunteer orientations the last Wednesday of each month and the first Saturday of each month. Tonight's orientation will be from 6:30 to 7:45 p.m. at its location at 3901A North Williams Avenue in Portland. SCRAP is a nonprofit organization, and its mission is to promote creative reuse and environmentally sustainable behavior by providing educational programs and affordable materials to the community. Volunteer activity at SCRAP ranges from working with the store, sorting material, making signs, chatting with customers, data entry and special projects, to the education and outreach programs, designing reuse projects for local schools, giving reuse presentations, chatting and playing scrappy games with folks at community events around town. For more information, contact Carol Millette at 503-294-0769. That's 503-294-0769. Or visit the web at scrapaction.org. There will be an education forum tonight on grand juries, criminal prosecution, and the use of confidential informants, presented by attorney Lauren Reagan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center. This event will be held tonight, 7 o'clock p.m. at Liberty Hall, and that address is 311 North Ivy Street in Portland. For more information, visit the web at www.cldc.org. Once again, it's mailing night for the Portland Books to Prisoners from 5 to 8 p.m., and it's held at 2362 Southeast 43rd Avenue. Portland Books to Prisoners is an all-volunteer project dedicated to assisting in the education and literacy of people who are incarcerated. They receive and respond to all letters from people in prison by sending books in the subject areas requested. If you want to get involved but can't make mailing nights, there are lots of things that need to be done, such as taking packages to the post office, picking up books from drop boxes, organizing fundraisers, and doing outreach work. For more information about this program, email pdxbooks2prisoners@riseup.net. You've been listening to the Community Calendar. This is Alicia Olson for KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.
Hola, yo soy Alma.
Yo soy Mirna.
Y yo soy Erika.
Y somos parte del colectivo Tonali. Te invitamos a que asistas a la junta de la mesa directiva de KBOO el sábado 25 de febrero a las 10 de la mañana en el 20 Sureste, Octava Avenida, media cuadra al sur de la calle Burnside. Sé un ciudadano activo de tu comunidad y de tu emisora KBOO 90.7 FM. Y también recuerda de escuchar el programa de Tonali todos los martes de 3:30 a 5 de la tarde.
Hi, I am Alma.
And I am Mirna.
And I am Erika Zacarias.
And we are part of the Tonali Collective. We invite you to attend the KBU Board of Directors meeting on Saturday, February 25th at 10 a.m., 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, one half block south of Burnside. Be an active part of your community radio station, KBOO. And remember to listen to Tonali every Tuesday from 3:30 to 5 p.m.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor An Evening in Vietnam, a benefit for Village School Foundation. Experience Vietnamese culture through music and dance featuring nationally known guitarist and storyteller Dun. Enjoy Vietnamese food and a special video presentation of the Village School Foundation's recent efforts to provide education resources to the children of Vietnam. The event will be held at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, February 25th at the PCC Rock Creek Campus, Building Number 3. For more information, please call 503-957-0740 or 503-997-2260.
KBOO Community Radio has an immediate opening for an interim membership coordinator. This is a temporary position lasting for a period of 90 days. The position will be responsible for the oversight of the membership drive and various other duties. For a complete job announcement, please visit our site online at www.kboo.fm. The position closes Friday, February 24th at 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 16th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 3rd through March 4th. This year's festival highlights include films from Angola opening and closing the festival, and an examination of the African legacy in Mexico through screening, symposium, and community conversation. Additionally, there will be a spotlight on AIDS in Africa, Women Filmmakers Week, and appearances by some of the directors at the film festival. For more information, visit AfricanFilmFestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.
Jump if you get belay to Bhutan. Drink if you get belay to Taken. Enjoy yourself as you think you sabi. Enjoy yourself as you think you sabi.